A good news print story out of Vienna, where Der Standard has been rising under the watch of its new editor-in-chief. We'll hear from him on what he makes of his first year in charge. We'll talk about the winners at our near-namesake Stack Magazine's annual awards for the best in independent print. Plus, we'll catch up with some of those recognised for excellence on the page in the past 12 months. A certain spirit of celebration pervades proceedings today on the Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up, we'll talk to the editor whose title, Anxi, scooped two gongs at this year's Stack Awards. And a friend of the show drops in to hand-deliver their latest issue, also commended at the awards. Just to show we're keeping pretty good company this week. But we start in Vienna. Austria's Der Standard newspaper celebrated its 30th anniversary last month, but it has another cause for celebration too. Its readership continues to grow, with the latest count showing that more than 500,000 Austrians read it every day. That's an increase of 1% on last year, which is not an insignificant figure considering the decline of daily newspapers worldwide. And it's thanks in large part to Der Standard's new editor-in-chief, Martin Kotinek, who assumed the role exactly a year ago after a three-year stint as deputy editor-in-chief of Germany's Die Zeit Online. Monocle's Alexei Korolev in Vienna sat down with Martin to discuss his first year in charge.
Es wird eine Zeitung sein, die im Konzert der internationalen Zeitungen mitspielen will. Das Niveau soll angesiedelt sein.
This is Austrian journalist and publisher Oskar Brauner speaking to the country's national broadcaster ORF in June 1988. Having already launched two successful magazines, Trend and Profil, Brauner is about to embark on a new venture, an independent daily newspaper, which he says will be modelled on the likes of the New York Times and Neue Zürcher Zeitung, a brand new product for Austria. Brauner didn't have a name for it yet, but by the time the first issue went to press in October 1988, it had got one, Der Standard.
So Der Standard is an independent newspaper. It's owned by Oskar Brauner, who created Der Standard 30 years ago when he came back from New York, where he was a painter. And at that time, his son was 15 years old, and he wanted him to read a proper paper. And he didn't really find a satisfying one at that time in Austria, so he created his own paper. And he envisioned a more liberal editorial perspective, which is our guiding principle today as well.
30 years on, Der Standard is part and parcel of Austrian politics and culture, and a constant bone of contention, too. Some see it as a mouthpiece for the liberal left, while others say it is conservative and elitist. Some praise its journalism, while others despise it. But almost everybody agrees it's been somewhat lacking in creativity and innovation in recent years. To remedy that problem, Der Standard's board of directors decided to bring in a new editor-in-chief in November last year, Martin Kotinek. A year into his new job, what has changed?
So with print, when I came in, we started with a slow relaunch, because a print is like a living room for our readers, and we don't want to just change everything at once. We wanted to make very small changes and improve the living room once in a while. So I started with a reader dinners. I invited 4 or 5 readers over for dinner, and we talked about their needs, what they want from news coverage and what they like about the Standard and what they don't like. And after, I think, maybe 10 or 12 of these dinners, you get a sense of what the main topics are that readers are asking for. And so we designed for these specific needs. For example, there was a big need to have a balanced view on new ideas of the government. So we came up with a new section, you can call it a pro and con section, where we collected all the arguments from all the experts on both sides, and we displayed it there. And you could do that really nicely in print because you have the whole page and you can display it like that. Just by talking to the readers and by designing for their needs, we slowly changed our sections and by that our layouts and our reporting.
But you came here with a background in media already. So when you came here with this background, did you identify some problems immediately? Did you identify some areas that needed improvement straight away?
We worked a lot on how we think about our stories. I think many newsrooms think about topics in a way how they create pages or how they fill sections. And we started to look more into how we create stories. So we came up with different velocities of stories. We started to think in a fast track, a middle track, and a slow track. I can give you an example if you want.
Please.
So there's the hospital in the north of Vienna, a new project. And we found out that a shaman was hired to create an invisible force field around the hospital so that everyone inside this magic bubble would be protected from whatever, bad forces. Mm-hmm. So this is the fast track to see this story and to write about it immediately. And then there would be the middle track, someone who can think about who's responsible, whom should we ask for an interview. So, for example, we found out that there is a site in the north of Vienna as well where they replanted an elderberry tree so it doesn't disrupt the energy force fields over there on that site. And also at the highways, they would put energy stones to prevent accidents. Mm. So you can see the bigger picture. Mm. And then at the slow track would be our weekend edition long read story about the obsession of Austria with esoterica. And the same we'll do now for online as well, because our website really needs a redesign. We have been studying a new approach with our German edition, derstandard.de, and now we are taking some of these insights from the German edition and, of course, new ideas we have for Austria and designing a new website for Austria.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me was that the look of the newspaper, the actual print edition, and the website, those two are completely different, and you wouldn't for the life of you know that this is the same publication.
Not only the website and the paper look different, they also had different logos.
Yeah.
So there was the print logo and the online logo, and now for our 30th anniversary, we found a new logo for both of them. It's now a combined logo, where we took parts of the online logo and parts from the print logo and created a new one. And I think it was by intention when the Standard was created. There was a print design chosen that made the impression as if the Standard has been there forever. That was by intention, by design. But you need updates once in a while. And that's what we did with the print design over the last year. We slowly updated it and improved people's living rooms by that.
Der Standard's Martin Kortenek in conversation with Monocle's Alexei Kodialov in Vienna. Back in January on this programme, we caught up with Indira Rojas to hear about a title that was challenging preconceptions about mental health and presenting great ideas, words and illustration about that very subject. Indira is the founder of ANXI, and its editor, Bobby Johnson, jetted into London earlier this week for the Stack Magazine Awards, where he was picking up two gongs. Will Hudson and Debbie Millman selected the ANXI team for Art Director of the Year, and judges John Cockley and Simon Armstrong acclaimed ANXI for Best Use of Illustration. Bobby made some time in his flying visit to London to pop into Midori House to talk to the Stack.
We've only been running it for 2 years, but it feels like it's been around for a long time. I think even when we put the first issue together, it was one of those moments that felt, you know, like everything coalesced and we've kept going since then. I think people are surprised when they realise, A, it's still pretty new, and B, that we're really a bunch of part-timers kind of doing it on top of our day job.
How do you manage then to get something that's so polished and it's so coherent, the way it all sits together, issue by issue and theme by theme, without being able to dedicate, you know, 100% of your time to it? Is there a secret? Good people?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll pressy this by saying, you know, Indy Rojas, who's the founder, I think she puts in a lot more time, although she still runs a design studio alongside ANXI. So the same team that does the design work for ANXI also works on commercial projects and does design projects for other clients. So it's one of the plates that she's spinning, and it's the same for the rest of us, you know, although maybe we're not all in the same loop. You know, I consult and I edit other stuff too. We started out that way. It was a passion project. You know, we'd meet at the weekends and we'd carve out, you know, an afternoon each week to get things going. And we've tried to keep more or less to that because, you know, it's one of those things. It could take up all your time if you wanted it to. Mm-hmm. And I hope that over time it becomes that and we can turn it into a really fully functioning publication that people can work on full time. But given that we talk about mental health, we're pretty careful about our own sanity, you know, and trying to balance it out and not let it become an overwhelmingly huge monster that takes up all of our time and leaves us all broken.
One of the issues that was obviously sort of in the frame at the Stack Awards was the sort of workaholism issue. Mm. And there would have been a certain bitter irony had the sort of work-life balance.
I mean, I think every issue we do is basically a reflection of our own, yeah, you know, our own struggles. So, you know, workaholism or boundaries, you know, these are questions we're coming up against when we're sort of brainstorming ideas of what the next theme's going to be. We look at ourselves first and know what our struggles are.
Just on that bigger picture, though, it's about mental health, mental well-being. And I think the timing felt apposite at launch and over the last couple of years. I don't know, I've detected a shift in the tone of broader coverage, and I don't know if that's partly because of the presence of Anksy and a few other kind of leaders in this space. Have you detected any sort of attitudinal shift broadly in the media just in that two-year frame? And would you like to think that Anksy's played a role?
I'd love to think we were part of it. It's hard to know when you're a small run kind of indie magazine what influence you're casting. But I certainly hope we're part of that conversation and help it move forward. I do think that's true. You know, I think mental health and understanding the kind of impact of our kind of inner lives and what it has on the rest of the world is really a big question. I think, you know, if you look at politics, if you look at social media, if you look at all the things we consume and the decisions we're making every day, I think once people start connecting the dots about mental health, both your own mental health and the mental health of others, then it's really hard to unsee it once you've started seeing it and you start thinking, oh, how is this affecting me? How is it affecting other people? And when you see someone losing their shit about something in the news, they're really struggling to comprehend and to process stuff and comes out in all these different ways. I do think the media coverage has changed. I don't think it's changed that much. I think if you're attuned to it, you see the shifts, mm-hmm, and it is a slow shift. But I do think it's happening. I think, you know, partly it's generational. You know, younger people than me are kind of more in tune with themselves a little bit and more open to discussing it. But I think when you look at Brexit, when you look at Trump, these decisions we make are the result of our own internal strife. And then it's writ large on the culture as a whole. And suddenly you're like, man, this is painful. Yeah. Let's talk about it.
A lot of those conversations I have at the moment is like, are we bottoming out in terms of how bad it's getting? I don't know. So that's, a broader question. Do you have a view? You strike me as quite an optimistic type.
I am an eternal optimist, but also a skeptic. I think it takes a long time to get somewhere. I think every day, I think we've reached the bottom and then there's a
horrible
the barrel has another layer to scrape. You can't change the bad opinions of other people, but you can help the people who are willing to engage in a conversation, you can talk to them, right? And so mental health is not everyone's bag. Some people don't want to speak about it the way we speak about it, which is in a pretty adult and sometimes explicit or sometimes fairly confrontational way for some people. That's not everyone's cup of tea. But if you are interested in it, we're there to have that chat with you and to show you some stuff, to show you some opinions you might not have understood before or to take you through someone's life. And if you come out of it being able to imagine yourself in someone else's shoes, that's a win.
There's a lot of talk about citizen journalism and this sort of thing. And I know you certainly had a long stint in newspapers. Mm. You know, you're no stranger to the idea of your editor wielding a red pen. And that was my background as well. And I think that made me much better as a journalist than I would have done in any other way, learning about it in theory or even reading and reading and reading. There's nothing like that red pen moment. Do citizen journalists, by definition, suffer because they don't have an editor? It's great that everyone can access a digital platform, but is it a problem that people don't learn some real old-fashioned editorial craft?
This is, I think, probably the defining question of my career, basically, is an editor's job is to help people see things they can't necessarily see themselves, whether that's seeing the story. You talk with a writer and they can't quite see the story or they're trying to articulate the idea and you help them do that. Or it's helping the craft, you know, helping choose the right words, know the moments of power, the moments where you can take somebody and blow their mind or change their perspective and really emphasize that. I worked for The Guardian for nearly 10 years. I launched my own publishing company, Matter, and we did a lot of stuff and we're doing stuff with ANXI. That's kind of very crafted editorial. I also worked for Medium.com for 5 years, and that was the opposite end of the spectrum most of the time. You know, thousands upon thousands of people writing constantly, some of it terrible, some of it great, but really having very little hand in the kind of day-to-day what people were publishing. I think you can learn a lot from books. You can learn a lot from reading other people, but you cannot replace the function of a great editor. I don't think that necessarily means that one invalidates the other. Someone's lived experience, or when they're talking from expert knowledge or from a deep place, that experience itself is massively valuable. You know, as a journalist, I can't go out and replicate that. I can't be that person. I can help that person tell their story, but I can't be that person. So I think it's really a shift between first-person experience and third-person reportage. Those two things are both vital and important. They all benefit from editing. Everything benefits from editing. This conversation will benefit from editing. But it's always a trade-off. You know, what is it you're trying to do? Are you trying to be immediate and powerful and in the moment? Or are you trying to be considered and thoughtful about how you tell the story? What we've seen a lot, you know, I sort of think a lot of the speed of modern journalism has tried to marry those two things together and try and bring in traditional reporting craft with very present first-person kind of accounting. And that only works if you're really, really good at it. I think there's a lot of people who want to be good at it and aren't. And that's either they come from the traditional background, they're trying to be more voicey, or they come from a, you know, citizen journalism background, they're trying to sort of use more traditional tropes to tell their stories. That's the place where bad stuff really sucks. And if you're an editor, I mean, this is the work I really enjoy, is marrying those things together and working at it. But it doesn't happen by accident when it's great. You know, you can read a mediocre story any day of the week, but the great ones stick with you, and the great ones have a lot of investment going into them. And that's just what it takes.
That was ANXI's editor, Bobby Johnson. Find out more about ANXI at anxiemag.com. Anyone for tennis?
Too big, too strong. Anderson.
And you probably already know Racquet. Appropriately enough, something of a game changer in independent publishing about sport, or sports, if you're in North America. Issue number 8 of Racquet is fresh off the presses, and our friend Caitlin Thompson, the publisher and co-founder of the magazine, stopped by to hand-deliver it in all its tactile glory. I began by asking Caitlin to reflect on the latest edition and its signature take on the most recent tennis season. Also marked, of course, by the big ATP season-closing event that wrapped the previous weekend here in London. Here's Caitlin.
Right now it feels like, you know, the closing of a chapter, which is nice because it gives us a pause to reflect. We're all playing indoor tennis. We're all a little creakier than we were, you know, and then everything picks up again in a few months when it goes back for the start of the 2019 season. So it really does feel like that rhythm certainly influences and speaks to what we're doing.
And I like the fact this is not an empty gesture. There's a tennis racket here. I don't know if people can, that's the sound of it. You're going to put out a bit of tennis this afternoon as well, even though it's quite chilly in London.
It's quite chilly in London. I played yesterday at the Lawn Tennis Association. I played against a very good 10-year-old Macedonian kid, because you have to know somebody. And in that case, it's an up-and-coming junior.
It is more inclusive, because tennis has at times had a bad rap for being an elitist sport and all the rest of it. But, you know,
a lot
people want to play,
deserving.
You can play.
One of the things I like very much about London in particular, and I think this speaks to what's so cool about the indie magazine community here too, is it's a little bit more interconnected. Casual players, casual fans, makers, doers are more involved in the game here. So it's our second biggest market behind New York and just ahead of LA.
And this is something that, again, we've spoken to you and to David about since you guys founded the magazine, is this idea of reclaiming some, I guess, a bit of cultural capital almost around the sport. Have you found, I mentioned already, you know, issue 8.
Yes.
Has that dynamic changed even in that, what is a relatively short period of time?
2 years now, yeah.
Is there an additional opportunity almost here to do something more, do you think?
Feels like it. Tennis is finally sort of realizing at least in an American-centric way, the basketball culture became pop culture because the game changed a little bit to accommodate that. The branding, the stadium experience, how cool the music was. This stuff matters. And I think football has known that for a very long time. You know, I think for us, tennis needs to go in that same direction. So whether we're influencing it or the heads of sport who are notoriously not super nimble and progressive.
Very, very diplomatic.
They, you know, I think are starting hopefully to look around the horizon about what other leagues and sports are doing.
We're also reflecting, you've already talked about the independent publishing scene, and we were earlier in the week at the Stack Awards, of course, and whether it is an interesting moment. And I wanted to get some reflections from you. You talk about the global nature of tennis. What about the global indie publishing scene? And I wonder how different the response to racket and to the broader project is, whether you're in Australia or in East Asia or in the States or here in London. Is that as markedly distinct as the seasonality of tennis almost?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for us being nominated for Magazine of the Award is such a cool thing, having this recognition. We were tapped for launch of the year a couple of years ago. And like I said, I think London is really home to and draws in these makers from around the world. I do think looking at the sort of indie mag scene, the titles featured in this, the most sort of curated high-end part of the landscape, are still mostly English titles. There's ones from Beirut, I think maybe two. There's a couple from Germany. European, certainly a handful in New York, one or two in Los Angeles. South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, South America, not so much. That, I think, speaks to the state of media. Largely, if you don't have a strong media, it's hard for you to have a strong independent media from which those two, one tends to come from the other and speak to the other, and there's a dialogue there. Certainly in our case, David and I coming from mainstream print publications, there are cool indie creators who are searching for this kind of stuff, whether it's a title about tennis or cycling or esoterica or whatever culture. Everywhere, because there are indie magazine shops in every city, in every corner. We just stocked at a Spanish store called Tambourine, which is literally in a forest outside of Madrid. Not a lot of foot traffic going into that place, I imagine. But these magazines, and I look, and it's the same wonderful sort of titles that we're always stacked next to in these stores, because everyone is trying to curate the same experience for their local communities. Where that goes, first, I think you have to see it, and then if you're a creator, seeing it, having it be in your world, passed around your friend groups or whatever it is, being able to translate it to your localized version of that is the next step. And I have had a couple of conversations with makers. This is my favorite part, by the way, meeting with people who are kind of on the precipice of starting what we've started, obviously in different categories and different conversations, and they all come to it with the same thing, like, okay, I saw a couple of different examples and it sort of filled out my mental palette. Now I know, based on what I want to say, I can steal ingredients from this or that, or a little bit of that cover design, a little bit of that matte paper choice, whatever it is.
And Kenny, does that extend then to the sort of financial modeling and the business strategy as well? Because obviously this is something where you guys leverage your expertise, which, you know, it gets this amazing calling card to go with the seasons of the game. And that opens doors and it prompts people to say, oh, you know, can you do that for us? And this could be a big corporation or something in tennis or something without. Would you say to, you know, maybe those people who are sort of on the crest of starting out, listen, go for it, do those things, borrow your thing, borrow those bits of thinking and bits of influence, but you do need to have that, you know, publishing hat. You need to be business savvy as much as you need to be editorial savvy.
It's interesting. I literally had this conversation earlier today with a young woman who is starting a feminist sports platform. It's a community celebrating just the making a space for women's sports very consciously. And we were having a very frank conversation about at what point her endeavor turns into print, at what point her endeavor turns into a sustainable business model that goes beyond just the initial reach of her idea. And doing this work on behalf of clients, brands, I think there's been a tradition, certainly myself as a journalist coming from a journalism school in a magazine journalism degree, nobody ever talks about business or business modeling or ideas. And I think that that's a real missed opportunity. And I think for me, in talking with this young woman and in thinking about what we've done in the past 2 years, we really didn't get snobby about the idea that telling stories is interesting to us. Telling stories with a partner, in some cases with the right partner, is just as inspiring, ambitious, and in some ways can, because they come with a whole bunch of backstory, we can go to really interesting places with that. And then ultimately, because we are mission-driven in this way that is trying to get tennis-adjacent, tennis sort of fans who don't know they're fans yet, and stopping at editorial misses a huge opportunity to change the visual landscape, going in with a business model and with an idea that brands are tired of working with creative agencies that are traditional and having a viewpoint that can go past your mission, can permeate every aspect of what you're doing. And I think, in fact, it should. And if you don't have a mission, you know, what are you doing?
Get one. So let's talk a little about this. You mentioned I'm one of the first to have a good old
brand. How does it feel?
There's a lot of good stuff in here.
Yeah.
Clay court, you can almost kind of feel and touch the fiber of it off the page. And my eye is continually drawn back to this big old Jimmy Connors piece, though.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that? Because there's some lovely illustration. I can already see a couple of top drawer anecdotes. I mean, it's an easy person to hang a lot of articles about.
Absolutely. And Joel Drucker, who wrote this piece, is one of the best in the business. He is somebody who just wants to call you up and tell you stories. And when he is at his best is when he's directed towards a ripe subject matter. And this was the case. We did this in collaboration with the New York Times in celebration of the U.S. Open. And the story is about Jimmy Connors' love-hate relationship with New York City. New York City is famously combative, aggressive city. And Jimmy Connors famously is a combative, aggressive guy. And he was vulgar. He was from the wrong side of the tracks. He's from East St. Louis, but raised by his mother, who basically was like a stage mom. She's like Gypsy Rose, like it's classic. Just the tropes here are classic. And it goes to him basically having this late career surge in 94 with a neon yellow racket. He's humping the air. It's decorum has been tossed out the window. But you give Joel this chance to track his rise, his fighting with the tennis establishment. And it just makes for a really interesting sort of journey. Dave wrote a piece about public tennis courts in New York. My Racket Magazine podcast co-host Renee Stubbs did an interview with Virginia Wade. Virginia Wade is amazing. We did a sort of huge layout to sort of give a publishing partner and the sort of people who would be reading the New York Times who might not be otherwise excited about this open, a really big, interesting lens. And if you read the editor's letter, which I know you will, Dave talks explicitly about how we selected the cover paper. He meant it to evoke a freshly swept clay court. And so it's got that grainy
It's a haptic experience.
Isn't it?
Reading
right.
And there's some Johnny Mack in there as well.
There's some Johnny Mack.
If you want some, you know, 70s, early 80s, or in, yeah, as you say, in context.
Johnny Mack talking about
90s.
Art.
There, you see.
By the way.
You wouldn't expect this.
And I have to draw attention to the cover. Radka Litmeritz, who's a Czech photographer who does a lot of fashion photography. The inserts as you open the cover are beautiful shots of Petra Kvitova taken at a old school former communist bloc, well, pre-communist bougie tennis club in Prague that's sort of fallen into disrepair during the communist years and now is sort of endangered. And this woman is Czech. She lives in Los Angeles. She kind of found racket totally randomly by playing at her local public tennis courts and saw someone wearing a racket t-shirt. He happened to be our creative director, and they struck up a friendship, created a working relationship. And Radka, when shooting Petra Kvitova for the cover of El Czech, had all this film left over, put Petra in a racket t-shirt. Just, it was such a cool thing. And she said, "Hey, I have these photos. Do you want to use them?" And I was like, I will move mountains
to move them.
The answer is absolutely yes.
Caitlin Thompson, publisher and founder of Racket, too modest to mention that her beautiful magazine was commended in the Best Original Nonfiction category on Monday night at the Stack Magazine Awards as well. Other winners, in case you're wondering, well, the editorial triumvirate behind the brilliant Skirt Chronicles scooped Editor of the Year, your correspondent was on that judging panel, for full disclosure, whilst the frankly magnificent Good Trouble, whom we met on this show back in September, won the coveted Magazine of the Year, and richly deserved that acclaim was too. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments, queries, general pointers about things to look at are welcome. Send them to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks very much for listening.